This is the GCN Radio Network.
Terrorist Abdul Malek Righi, a NATO agent, an arm of NATO and the presence in Afghanistan, captured by the Iranians, but with decisive help from Pakistan, according to my information, and therefore an act of rebellion, if you like, by the Pakistanis against their assigned role in this deplorable, monstrous scenario of state-sponsored false flag terrorism being imposed on them by the U.S. and the British. So that's one of them. You can see that, and that is showing actually today, Friday, the 25th of February, because this Righi has started talking and confirms pretty much what I said in the analysis, that he was getting money from the CIA. We'll get to this in just a minute. I've also taped the Crosstalk program on Monday. So when you hear this on Monday, the 28th, I guess it is. Not so sure on the date. Monday, anyway, will be a program on Soviet America, parallels between the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1990-1991 and the current situation here in the United States. And there are such parallels. That would be Monday, March 1st, actually. And that means that today is Friday, the 26th of February. Sorry about that. So Monday, March 1st, you can see Crosstalk with Peter Lavelle, repeated every 2 hours on Russia Today. You can also see it at the Russia Today website. I'm not sure which of the two Russia Today websites it's going to be on, because Russia Today now has two websites, one for the programs originating in Moscow, which I think covers Crosstalk, but another website for the programs initiating here in Washington, D.C. So if you want to see the one about Righi, you're going to have to go to the Washington, D.C. one, or better yet, go directly to Tarpley.net, direct to the source, where you'll also see a short commentary that I put together about this. Now, let's dive in and look at the question of Abdul Malek Righi. Now, this is the leader of Jundullah. Indeed, Jundullah is a family operation of the extended Righi crime family. The Righi family has infested the border between Pakistan and Iran, and that's Balochistan on both sides, for decades. The father of these two brothers, who are now in Iranian custody, was a well-known royalist supporting the Shah. They don't get along too well with the regimes on either side, and therefore they go to work for CIA, MI6, the usual suspects, and indeed for NATO, and I think that's the interesting thing. So the story this week coming from the Iranians was that Abdul Malek Righi was cavorting in Dubai, which of course is a hot corner of the world these days from many points of view. He was trying to get from Dubai to Kyrgyzstan, and he flew over Iranian airspace in an airplane. And the Iranians scrambled jets and forced his plane to land in Iran, at which point Righi was taken into custody. Now, this is a dramatic story. It sounds like what Oliver North did to an Egyptian airliner that was going from Egypt to Tunisia, most likely, back in 1985. This is in the wake of the Achille Lauro case, the Klinghoffer murder, and Abu Abbas, the perpetrator of this action from the Palestinian side, was going from Egypt over to someplace in the Maghreb. And then Oliver North sent U.S. carrier aircraft and forced this plane down in Sigonella, Sicily, where we had that famous standoff between the Italian Carabinieri and the U.S. Delta Force, or whatever it was, with the Italians eventually winning out, since, of course, it was their territory, probably the most decisive action in the career of Bettino Craxi, and the thing that eventually got him thrown out by the U.S., because they did not forget this assertion of national sovereignty by the Italians. But this dramatic story, I'm afraid, may not be at least the whole story. The Pakistani ambassador to Tehran claims a significant part of the credit for Pakistan, saying we tipped them off, or he actually puts it in somewhat vague terms. It could therefore either be that it was the Pakistanis, the ISI, the much maligned ISI, in a moment of independence, trying to assert their own sovereignty in this case, telling the Iranians, watch out, the head of Baluchistan, your public enemy number one, the most wanted terrorist on the Iranian most wanted list, Abdulmalek Righi, is in your airspace. Bring him down. Or another version circulating at various places. There's a site called Iranian Diplomacy. There are a couple of others saying that it was actually the Pakistanis who captured Righi and delivered him to the Iranians. So, of course, the Iranians deserve their moment of glory because they have indeed captured a very dangerous and violent enemy. But I think the really interesting thing is the fact that Pakistan has played this singular role in it. Now, the Iranians claim they did it all by themselves, but the Pakistani ambassador in Tehran says, no, Pakistan had a significant role in it. And I'm sure time will tell. What this does, though, is it tends to decapitate and cripple this Jundullah at a critical moment. Now, a couple of things more about it. Jundullah, you'll remember, last October 18th, was the organization claiming credit for a bombing in the city of Pishin in Iranian Baluchistan. 40 to 50 killed, including two or three top generals, national commanders of the Pasdaran Revolutionary Guard. Previous to that, Jundullah's claim to fame is the blowing up of a Shiite mosque, killing 25 people. The important thing there is that Jundullah is Sunni, the Iranian regime, of course, Shiite, so it's ethnic and religious at the same time. So Jundullah is a twofer in that sense, right? It's a religious and ethnic rebellion, and it's on both sides. If you get the Baluchistan riled up and in insurrection, then you've essentially carved Pakistan and Iran. So two enemies for the price of one. And the price, of course, is money. Seymour Hersh, writing in The New Yorker, points out that some years ago that Jundullah is part of the apparatus of regime change and subversion in Iran maintained by the United States to the tune of $400 million. The Daily Telegraph of London has confirmed all that, and so has Brian Ross of ABC News. Concerning Righi himself, Abdulmalek, now in jail, and talking, too, because you can see his films are on Russia Today all day, today, Friday. Righi is reported by the Iranians to have met Yap Dehoop Scheffer, the former Secretary General of NATO. But he met him at the time that Yap Dehoop Scheffer was the Secretary General of NATO. Whether he's met this new guy, Fogh Rasmussen of Denmark, not known, but why not? And Righi has consorted and connived with NATO generals in Afghanistan. And I guess the question is, does that include McChrystal? This would be right up McChrystal's alley. He, of course, a special ops, covert ops hand from Iraq, by all odds, the creator of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. McChrystal meet Righi? It is a big, big deal, and we'll be back in a minute.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. We're just giving you the rundown on Abdulmalek Righi, the boss of that mafia family engaged in smuggling, drug running, and, of course, terrorism, blind terrorism, bombing Shiite mosques, killing dozens of people, and that's Jundullah. Jundullah, a false flag outfit claiming to be the pure Islamic fundamentalism of the Sunni variety, and in reality an arm of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization and the occupation of Afghanistan. And, of course, targeting in that process Pakistan and Iran, who are the real targets of this whole operation. So Righi now in jail. Righi's brother also in jail in Iran. He had been convicted and sentenced to death for earlier bombings. He has now been commuted, I think, his sentence commuted. So he had already been telling these stories. But now we have film of Righi himself talking about how he met with the CIA, got money, and so forth. This is another front, along with the Christmas Day patsy, who was deliberately allowed to keep his visa at the urging of an unknown U.S. agency. This is another case where this whole policy of state-sponsored false flag terrorism is close to being revealed. And indeed, it's to be expected that the Iranians will stage a show trial in grand style of this Abdulmalek Righi, where he will testify in detail. They claim again that he met Yaptah Hupshefer, NATO generals. They claim that the U.S. gave him an Afghanistan passport, that he had a UAE, United Arab Emirates passport given by the U.S., and other things. And what other things will he tell? A lot of worried people in Foggy Bottom at the State Department and out in Langley at the CIA as a result of this. And it simply shows the inherent bankruptcy of this policy. Now, the other thing is, what's going on right now? If you look at RIA Novosti website and some others, in some places it's available in English, you can see a statement by the Taliban in Afghanistan where they say that the purpose of the Marja offensive is to attack Chinese economic interests in Baluchistan, especially the port of Gwadar, which we've talked about in this broadcast. You'll remember that before the beginning of the Marja offensive in the Helmand province, Helmand Valley, Helmand province of Afghanistan a couple of weeks ago, everybody was wondering out loud, why did the U.S. command in Afghanistan so systematically pre-announce that they were going to attack the city of Marja? Why did they do that? My own view is that they said, right? General McCaffrey had gone on CNN saying the reason for this was that the U.S. wanted those Taliban fighters out of Helmand province and didn't care how, and if they could leave without fighting so much, the better. It was obvious to me that that meant that they were trying to force them down the Helmand River Valley and into Baluchistan, in other words, into Pakistan, into the area of Quetta, but into the area of Gwadar above all. And that's frankly what these Taliban also say. They have a somewhat more expansive analysis. They say that the purpose of all this, the Marja offensive, which is the Marines claim to have taken, conquered the city of Marja this morning. Fine. And that's no doubt they can do that. What they're really concerned with is driving those fighters out and into Pakistan. Remember, the policy is to export the Afghan civil war into Pakistan and into Iran, if that's at all possible. The Taliban line is this. They say that the goal of the offensive in Marja and Helmand is to target the Chinese economic interests in Pakistani Baluchistan, and in particular the port of Gwadar. The idea being that if you can get the Taliban into Pakistani Baluchistan and into the area around Gwadar above all, you will then have a pretext to militarize it. You can go in with Blackwater, or you can go in with the U.S. military forces. And we see from various incidents that they are there in Pakistan on the ground, despite the denials of Ambassador Holbrooke. So if the U.S. can put military forces, say, into Gwadar, what can you do? You can kick out the Chinese. You can interfere with their whole operation, bust that up, prevent any pipelines from being built, because one of the possibilities for Gwadar is you use that as a tanker terminal for ships coming from Saudi Arabia. You put the pipeline up through Pakistan, over the Himalayas into China, and you've cut a good 10,000 miles or more off the trip. You've avoided the U.S. and British fleets. You've avoided the choke point at the Straits of Malacca, pirates, and all kinds of other problems that you otherwise have. And suppose the U.S. takes over Gwadar, you can use it as a logistics base. Right now, the supply line starts in Karachi, goes all the way up through Pakistan, has to cross that very dangerous bottleneck of the Khyber Pass. If you have Gwadar, you can supplement that with another convoy route, which would go up the Helmand River, I guess, and into southern Afghanistan, so that you could have the logistics for your operation going through there. So, in retrospect, now what was planned is obviously what we can call a double envelopment of Pakistani Balochistan. On the one hand, the Marja offensive drives the Taliban into Pakistani Balochistan, and at the same time, Jundullah is ready to strike. Jundullah usually focuses on targets on the Iranian side, but looks like they were preparing to lift and shift, because they can then go into Balochistan on the Pakistani side and do all kinds of mayhem. And that seems to be what Rigi is saying, that the CIA gave him bombs and said, here, go and set these off in Pakistan and create mayhem, right? We have the accusation that Blackwater has done this in places like Peshawar. So a double envelopment, but of course, at this point, one side of the double envelopment has been decapitated. So that is what you are seeing as these events unfold. So hang on for a trial of Rigi, which will, I think, go far towards exposing the real nature of state-sponsored false flag terrorism in our time. Noticeable is that The Dawn, Pakistani English-language newspaper, ran a banner headline on the front page that the arrest of Rigi was a godsend for Pakistan and a lucky break for Pakistan. Usually the line is, also by various pseudo-critics of the U.S. regime, that the Pakistani ISI is the sum of all evil and the good U.S. is there being betrayed. In reality, it looks like it's the other way around. The U.S. is pushing this terrorism as a tactic, and the ISI forced to go along, but now finding a way to rebel. We'll be back in a minute.
This is the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Welcome to Harvey in Washington, D.C., recommending, as always, Tarpley.net. That's also where you can find all of my books, Surviving the Cataclysm, Obama the Postmodern Coup, The Unauthorized Biography of Barack H. Obama, 9/11 Synthetic Terror Made in USA, The Unauthorized Biography of George Bush the Elder, plus translations in French, Spanish, Italian, Japanese, German, Modern Greek edition coming up fairly soon. So in terms of the U.S. effort in Afghanistan, today at the National Press Club, General McCaffrey, commentator for CNN, was there, and I had occasion to ask him, General, what about what the Taliban are saying about the real purpose of this operation? And he said, well, the Marines have carried on all kinds of psywar and deception. They have been announcing an attack on Marja for the last 6 to 9 months, and now they've finally done it. So the Taliban was fooled anyway. I don't know. But perhaps the most dramatic thing McCaffrey said today is that in the springtime, which means in about a month, the U.S. casualty rate in Afghanistan will rise to 200 to 500 a month. That's killed, wounded, and missing, presumed captured, all three, 200 to 500 a month. You're talking about 10 casualties to 15 to 17 per day, a heavy toll coming up. And this is an authoritative source. I'm sure he sits in on all the briefings at the Pentagon. So other than this, what do we know? U.S. naval presence in the Gulf seems to be quite robust. I think two battle groups now and another one coming in the near future. But it's on the ground that they're having trouble. We've heard that Gates has read the Riot Act to the European NATO allies. Where are the troops we need for the Afghanistan meat grinder? the Dutch government has collapsed. Balkenende, the reactionary neocon left over from the Bush era, because the Labour Party of the Netherlands said no to this useless sacrifice of Dutch troops, that government has now fallen, and I guess they're headed towards early elections. Ambassador Holbrook is in desperation going to Tiflis, Georgia, to try to get Georgian troops from the fascist madman dictator Saakashvili to try to beef up the NATO presence in Afghanistan. So they are scraping the bottom of the barrel. They're going to the Georgian toy army as distinct from these other NATO armies, which are at least relatively serious. So Holbrook is having to go outside of NATO because, thank God, the Georgians are not yet members of NATO, nor should they ever be. Notice also the plan to expand NATO into Ukraine is now a dead duck with Yanukovych, the pro-Moscow candidate, or even just normal Ukrainian reasonable self-interest. The color revolution crowd with Yushchenko and Tymoshenko, the gas princess, they're out. They're finished. Tymoshenko has thrown in the towel. So right now, there's not going to be an extension of Ukraine into NATO. Very interesting to keep score. U.S. color revolution in Ukraine rolled back after 6 years. Color revolution in Iran failing, sputtering, fizzling. And now this rebellion by Pakistan, and we're seeing that in the most distant corners of the empire where the U.S. had pushed itself forward relentlessly, that we're seeing signs of weakness on the limes, right, on the imperial frontier or even beyond the frontier. The ability to project subversion into a country like Iran seems to be declining. So you got all kinds of troubles in NATO and this reported coup d'etat attempted by the Turkish generals. Now, the coup d'etat itself, Operation Sledgehammer, I think, 2003. But right now, a purge of the Turkish army by the civilian government, as far as we can see, certainly going to have to study that one. But it shows that all is not well in the NATO house of cards. Things are decidedly on the dicey side. So we should look at this. The other thing I would point to is this really monstrous propaganda exercise by CNN, which aired last Saturday and Sunday evenings. And this is Cyber Attack, We Were Warned, a really interesting attempt to recycle all of the old plug uglies of the 9/11 Commission and related times from the Bush administration. This is an exercise, a war game in effect, being held at the Bipartisan Institute. That sounds awful. And the idea is that the U.S. is under cyber attack. So you have a fake meeting of the National Security Council with Chertoff, the profiteer, right? The guy who wants to have everybody appear on full body scans because he gets a rake off on everyone he sells. Chertoff is the head of the National Security Council. Jamie Gorelick, the CIA representative on the Kane-Hamilton 9/11 Commission, she's the attorney general. Joe Lockhart, the press attaché of the Clinton White House, is a counselor to the president. John Death Squad's Negroponte is he's the Secretary of State. A lot of these characters really from the invisible government. Bennett Johnson, former senator, is the Secretary of Energy. Fran Townsend, Bush, the younger veteran, is the Department of Homeland Security. And McLaughlin, the former head of the CIA, is the Director of National Intelligence. So they go through a scenario where something called March Madness begins to attack cell phones. They eventually find that that came from Sudan, interesting, main source of Chinese oil in Africa so far, probably 7% of Chinese oil coming from Port Sudan. And then after the attack on the cell phone system, it kicks over from the cell phone system into the internet. that begins to shut down air traffic control, airports shut down, trains cannot travel, and then it begins to attack the electrical grid, and you get all kinds of panic. You get the U.S. grinding to a halt, National Guard sent in, everything militarized. And I think the important point is China is mentioned, but the country that is targeted overwhelmingly in this simulation broadcast on CNN last Saturday and Sunday is Russia, because it turns out that the way that you see this virus is your screen begins to show footage of the Russian Red Army marching along with appropriate military music, and they say the server that is the source of all this is located in Irkutsk, I think in Siberia, but certainly in Russia. So the interesting thing about this is that it takes the language of confrontation and retaliation from the Cold War, the sort of straight Dr. Strangelove vocabulary of nuclear deterrence and first strike and second strike, and it translates that into the terms of cyber warfare. And there's a question at one point, the people in this fake National Security Council chaired by Chertoff are asked, well, could this just be the Taliban? Not the Taliban, but Al-Qaeda. Could this not be bin Laden and his group? And essentially, this is dismissed with a certain amount of scorn, saying, well, those guys all live in caves. How could they do that? So the mythology is now being dumped. Naturally, if they live in caves, which I don't think they do, but if they live in caves, they can't do it. Neither can they do 9/11, and they can't do this cyber attack. So there's an attempt to shift, to revamp, to rework the mythology and the memes to suit this cyber stuff. Target Russia. We'll be back in a minute.
America's number one source for independent talk radio for over a decade. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Just one last item on the U.S.-Russian relationship in the wake of that CNN cyber attack special targeting Russia. The strategic arms reduction talks, the need to replace that treaty, which expired last December, reported to be bogged down. Telephone call between Obama and Medvedev this week, instructing the negotiators to try to solve it, but not solving it. Still important divergences indicating not all is well between Moscow and Washington, which is otherwise obvious. But now, we are now, I believe, about 1 week from the referendum in Iceland about whether the people of Iceland want to accept this outrageous extortion and blackmail of the British, the Dutch, whose government has just fallen, as we've heard, plus the International Monetary Fund and, of course, the European Commission in Brussels and the European Central Bank, all devoted to the sanctity of debt. So I'm very glad to be able to go once again direct to Reykjavik, direct to the fighting front for Thorarin Einarsson, to try to get the flavor of what's going on there in the streets and what the situation is, any last polls and so forth. So, Thorarin, welcome.
Yes, thank you.
So, what can you tell us? We're all ears. 1 week to the vote. Am I right?
Yes, it's only 1 week, and well, there are not any new polls, but I think it should be about 85-90%. The question is if people show up to vote. But it's kind of a very embarrassing that the governments of UK and Ireland have already made an offer that is considered 300 million euros better than the former. Actually, it was rejected from Iceland, but you know that's all, not just the government but also the opposition, and they're trying to make a better deal. At I think though that the seems that the Netherlands is not willing to continue. But anyway, we have the at least a better offer. So it is kind of embarrassing to say yes in the coming referendum.
Okay, so it sounds like the British and the Dutch are already realizing that the handwriting is on the wall and the old deal is going to be rejected. Now, if there's a new deal, does that have to go through a referendum also?
No, that's it. Of course, there is no decision, you know, anything in here about that. We only have this referendum, but it's going to happen in 1 week. And but you know, even the Minister of Finance, he just said today, maybe mistakenly that he was not even sure if he would show up to cast his vote. Only that he would say yes if he would actually take the effort to go there and vote.
Let me ask you, is there a legal minimum in terms of percentage of turnout? In other words, people voting either way. Is there a legal minimum below which the referendum is invalid, or is it just, is it 50% plus one of everybody who shows up?
Actually, it is quite simple that the legislations around the referendums, they are very poor. And so I don't think there will be any issue regarding to that.
Well, I guess the task of right-thinking people like yourself is now to try to get the vote out. In other words, to urge people to go and vote against the International Monetary Fund, London, The Hague, Brussels, and the Frankfurt Central Bank.
Yeah, well, there is, of course, one thing that it could be easy to interpret the outcome, however it will go, in different ways. And, of course, there are people like some who are willing to accept the former deal before, and they say, of course, that's ridiculous to do it now, since we already have a better deal. But then there are others who don't want to pay at all. So people are really giving very different messages with their no vote.
So you're saying that after this election, the no vote will split again between those who want a better deal and those who refuse to pay?
Yeah, there is a no vote that says, well, we don't want to pay anything, and a no that is just common sense, you know, we already have a better deal.
It sounds like the younger generation is saying no to the IMF there in the background.
Yeah, it is quite probably getting stronger in general, opposition and also political awareness, you know, what IMF is really about and how it's behaving.
The other thing that strikes me is you've got this case of Greece, and I wonder if people in Iceland are following Greece, because they are under attack by Goldman Sachs, shorting their bonds and, of course, shorting the euro. It's the kind of speculative attack that Soros is famous for. He did it in 1992 against the European rate mechanism. But the Greeks have responded with a very large and successful general strike, which I think is absolutely exemplary. And maybe the program is not the clearest and the alternatives to the IMF are not spelled out, but at least the Greeks are fighting. And I think that probably has some inspirational effect. Am I right?
Yeah, well, I think it's been said here in Iceland that we actually have a more serious crisis, but the Greeks, they are you know, responding more well aggressively or actively, you could say. And I think Icelanders are not, or maybe they're just tired. Of course, they had a very long wave of demonstration throughout several months. It's a feeling that Icelanders have become a bit tired. And it seems many people think it's pointless to always go to show up in protest, since it doesn't really influence policy making, you know, the government. And I think many people are feeling it kind of like a hopeless, and we really need kind of new wave, new energy, and new front.
Any final events? Is it like some kind of a final rally, final, you know, in that famous square in front of the Althing? Anything?
No, well, there have been weekly demonstrations every Saturday, and actually there have been more people showing up. And these events have been getting stronger. So it is every Saturday at 3 o'clock, like tomorrow, people will show up. And that's always
a
signal.
That's the last one before the vote. That's the last opportunity before the vote.
Actually,
the vote is now the following Saturday, right?
Yes. So, so tomorrow, the next protest will be on that very day, the 6th of March, a referendum.
Well, the Spanish Prime Minister Zapatero says that Spain is under concerted speculative attack. And, of course, they are. Iceland is even in a different category because whatever borrowing Greece and Spain and some other countries have done, Iceland never borrowed the money. They never signed. There is no legal obligation, right? There's no reason to pay. It's just pure extortion that the British and the Dutch show up and say, guess what? You owe us $6 billion plus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was really hoping to that we would get focused more on the financial attack itself, because the main issue has been here just the consequences, not really what really caused the crash in the first place, and the elite, the financial elite behind the scenes.
That's our music. We've got to run, but we'll get you one more time before the big vote. We'll get you on the eve of the vote next week.
Yep.
We'll see you then.
Okay, we do that.
And we'll be back in a minute.
Okay.
We go directly to the source, and that is the Alpha Birther, Phil Berg, Distinguished Attorney of Philadelphia, former Democratic State Committee man, Democratic County Chairman in the past of Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, candidate for Senator and Governor in the Democratic primaries, and a lifelong Democrat. So this whole story with Orly Tate does not hold water. So welcome, Phil.
Thank you. My pleasure to be on with you. This has been a fabulous week. Things are really turning the corner, I think, as I believe I related to you last week. But for the listeners, when I put out a press release about 2 weeks ago now for a birth certificate march in Washington, which we're going to have, we don't have the date yet. Everyone has to stay tuned and go to my website, ObamaCrimes.com. But the next day at the National Prayer Breakfast, Obama said, I'm paraphrasing, the correct exact words are on my website, but at the end of his remarks, he said, no one should question my faith. He paused, and he said then, or my citizenship. So I believe we're getting to him, or we're getting to the people around him. I think basically, if you think about it, Obama is basically a wind-up doll. They're telling him what to say. Remember when he first went into office, there was a question whether he could use his BlackBerry. I think they're allowing him to use it under certain conditions, because I think that's where he gets information how to proceed. Think how he ran for office, everybody. For everyone that questions this, first off, I'm the attorney seeking the truth whether Obama is constitutionally eligible to be president. We believe 100,000% that he is not, that he is a phony, he's a fraud. This is the biggest hoax on the United States of America in over 230 years. And I think he gets instructions on the BlackBerry. Think about it. He ran as a candidate of change. His cabinet is not a candidate of change. I think the powers that be in this country that control money said to him, you know, Berg's right. You're an illegal alien. You have no business being president. If you want to be president, you've got to play ball our way. And that's why the cabinet is the way it is, and that's where the programs that he has come forth with during this past 13 months are such they're not the programs he ran on for the candidate of change. I think he's being told what to do. He set himself up to be blackmailed internally and externally, and we're in a real constitutional crisis. But since I announced
Absolutely.
the since I announced his birth certificate march in Washington, and we've asked people to fax and email and mail copies of their birth certificate to us, we've been getting a tremendous response. The best response I've gotten from the general public in 19 months. And people are clamoring for the dates so they can make arrangements to come in from all over the country. I think this could be the biggest march ever by the initial response I'm getting. We're still in the planning stages and permit stages and stuff like that, but we'll be out with a date so that people can plan to be there. I think the reason is that, as I've stated all along, we have to make the public more aware of the situation. And I believe that only, I keep using the number of 20 million. I think about 20 million people know about what's going on. My goal in the next couple months is to raise the public awareness to 100 million. Because a birth certificate, which is not the main issue I'll go into, but a birth certificate is something every one of your listeners must produce 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times in their lifetime. And this is crucial to know because our position is Obama has produced nothing to show that he was constitutionally qualified to be president. Now, in addition to the birth certificate, because I just put out a flyer, and it'll be in the Washington Times Weekly, which is going to press today, I think, and it'll be out in people's homes on Monday all across this country, the question of Obama and Indonesia citizen. See, there's no question people on the Internet are fighting us back and forth on the birth certificate saying Obama showed us his. Well, first of all, he didn't show his. He showed a certification of live birth, or a COLB. And what that doesn't have, that a birth certificate has, is the weight of the baby, the length of the baby, the hospital name, and the doctor's signature. So that is not on a COLB, but it's on a birth certificate. And people can identify. Everyone out there must produce a birth certificate between 1 and 10 times or more in their lifetime. They need it for... they need it for Little League. They need it for a passport. They need it for marriage. They need it for college entrances. They need it for entrance to school. They need it for baptism. They need it so many times so people can identify with this issue. The Tea Party people in this country, the heads, don't want to deal with this issue, but the rank and file do. I've got an enormous response from people. Even as I told you last weekend, I was at the CPAC convention in Washington, D.C., and whereas I didn't speak, I got a fabulous response. I'd say I got a 99% positive response to what I'm doing. I was being recorded by some independent from overseas, and then he turned his camera and mic around to the audience, and there was not one person who disagreed with me. There were several people who just wanted more information. And Belgium TV interviewed me and other people. It's a big story around the world. And now I'm not sure, well, you're probably aware of it, you're aware of everything, but for your listeners, the Arizona legislature just passed a statute stating that anyone running for president in 2012 must show that they're constitutionally qualified. And that legislation is, as I understand it, being introduced throughout this country, which will make this march even bigger, I think, because people can identify with the issue on birth certificate. But more significant, as I stated, is the Indonesia issue, because he was adopted or acknowledged in Indonesia. And what happens when you're adopted, you know people out there that have been adopted, or many of you have adopted children. The child takes your last name. The child basically disowns the country he or she came from. That's the same thing happened with Obama. In his book, his parents had divorced. He says, my stepfather, Lolo Sotoro, returned to Indonesia before my mother and I. And when I got there, I immediately went to school. Well, you can only go to school there if you were a natural of Indonesia, which meant that you were either born there or acknowledged or adopted there. And we have a copy on our website, which is ObamaCrimes.com, of his school record, which indicates his name is Barry Sotoro, his nationality is Indonesia, and his religion is Islam. Now, that's significant, Webster, because if he hasn't legally changed his name since that time, and there's no evidence he has, his legal name is Barry Sotoro, so he has committed fraud every time he's used his name as Barack H. Obama in the 50 states when he filed to run for president, and he was sworn under Barack Hussein Obama. Hussein you couldn't use during the campaign, but he was sworn in under that name, and every time he has used it since that time. And that's significant because there's no indication, and also, I'm sorry, there's indication that when he was at Occidental, everyone called him Barry. So I don't know when he decided to change his name, but there's no evidence he did it legally. People say that a child cannot be disenfranchised or by a parent. Well, true to a point, between the ages of 18 and 21, Obama himself could have renounced his citizenship in Indonesia and taken an oath to reaffirm any allegiance he had previous to the United States, if he had any. I don't believe he had any in the first place, because I really believe he was born in Mombasa, Kenya, where his paternal grandmother, Sarah, says, and it's on tape on our website, in Swahili, where she says she was in the hospital when he was born there. So the response is phenomenal. I'm asking people, please, to help us out, contribute money. It's going to take a lot to get this event going on. The march will be a day. We're going to have the birth certificate march in Washington with everyone, hopefully bringing a copy of their birth certificate. It's going to be a peaceful revolution, peaceful. The reason I'm doing that, and we're going to do something about it, there's the Orly Tate's out there who I can't stand, and I usually don't talk against anyone. She's having her minions, her people, put out information that we're looking for violence. We want no violence.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. A new low for Orly Tate. Thanks very much, Bill. More power to you. That blackmail issue, I think, is really important. Anybody can understand that.
Great.
We'll see you next week.
Okay, ObamaCrimes.com.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN, great talk radio starts here.
Coming second wave of the world economic depression, right? We've had November 1929, and now it's getting on towards a year and a half later. It'll be 2 years later. And if we go back to the previous depression, you'll see that the big event after 1929, in November, turns out to be September 1931, when the British, the Bank of England, defaulted on gold payment, the bankruptcy in effect of the Bank of England, the end of the world, which destroyed the only world monetary system that there was. And right now we're seeing that. Let me just point out about Greece that we mentioned before in our Iceland segment. The people in Greece at least have the reality, the good sense, those Greek trade unionists, to fight the austerity, the shock therapy, the destruction of the social safety net, the looting of education, and all this free market claptrap, a slave ideology that makes people into slaves of the finance oligarchs. And now in the United States, the Tea Party, at least the Tea Party as explained by Dick Armey, Gingrich's sidekick, and by Richard Mellon Scaife, the arch-reactionary, the Tea Party says you've got to demand that IMF shock therapy be visited on your country and the social safety net destroyed. And if you don't go for that, you're not reactionary enough. So now they're even saying that Scott Brown, who is reactionary plenty, is not reactionary enough because he voted for a covering jobs bill just as a kind of political cover for himself. But now let's look at the second wave of the depression. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation has come out with its quarterly banking report. This does not look good. I think an all-time high now in problem banks, or at least a recent year high. And we're told now that the commercial real estate crisis is coming in with a special ferocity. We're now up to $1.5 trillion of commercial real estate leases likely to blow, to go into default, with all of those losses accruing now to the banks. We're told, I think this past week, that in the previous year, 2009, we had something like 1.8 million foreclosures, and the estimate that I heard is that the coming year we'll see 4.5 million foreclosure. So if you get that together, and if you figure that each foreclosure represents three people, if not four, you're getting into essentially you're approaching 20 million internal refugees, displaced persons, victims of this economic depression and of things that should have been outlawed, like credit default swaps should have been outlawed. Adjustable rate mortgages should have been outlawed. And the solution for foreclosures is to stop beating around the bush and ban foreclosures, freeze them for 5 years or the duration of the crisis, whichever lasts longer. Now, the other big thing this week, of course, is Greece all over the place. The modus operandi here is the Soros hedge fund Wolfpack attack. Back in 1992, remember, Soros and the group of hedge funds that followed his lead attacked the European rate mechanism. And in particular, they attacked the British pound. And what was it that Soros had in effect stolen a £5 note, or was it a £10 note from every man, woman, and child in the British Isles as a result of his shorting of the pound? Now, what you have this time is a concerted action. We know that Goldman Sachs was on the inside selling derivatives to the Greek government. How can you hide debt with derivatives? Because they're off balance sheet. They're not reportable. If Brooksley Bourne had succeeded against Bob Rubin and Greenspan, derivatives on the U.S. side of the equation would have been reportable as of 1998-99. But, of course, Greenspan said that was communism. That would interfere with the wonderful genius and magic of the marketplace. So the European Commission went along with that, saying, yeah, you can have derivatives off balance sheet. Don't report them. That is the end. Derivatives have got to be on balance sheet. We want to know where they are because we're going to tax them. We're going to slap a Tobin tax, a Wall Street sales tax, a trading tax, a securities transfer tax, call it a banker's sales tax on them. Goldman Sachs pays no taxes, virtually 1%, 2%, some trifling sum. And above all, they may pay a little bit of tax on their profits. We want to tax their turnover if they've got a flash trading, program trading, high-frequency trading apparatus going so they can make thousands of trades per second. Great, boys. We want 1% of every one of those trades. And that will take the life out of the booze for Blankfein and the other boys at Goldman Sachs, for Mac and his gang at Morgan Stanley, Diamond at J.P. Morgan Chase, and the rest of these characters. Don't forget Tandit the Bandit at Citibank. Now, the idea was back in the autumn, we saw the dollar going down, down, down. We reached $150 to a euro. We were headed for $155 to a euro. And we were getting to the point where the fires of hyperinflation, I think, were close to kicking in, or at least incipient hyperinflation. So what they've done is to say, let's gang up and beat up Frankfurt and the euro. Let's have a speculative attack, a bear raid on the euro. And the way you do that is sort of what Soros did in 1992, which is attack the weak link. And the weak link at the moment is Greece with a 13% deficit in terms of the percentage of deficit compared to their gross domestic product, a very dubious value in itself. So let's export the dollar depression to Europe by having a speculative attack on Greece and on Spain. And Zapatero has said now, he's screaming bloody murder, that Spain is under concerted speculative attack. It is a bear raid. It is economic warfare, if you will, to relieve the pressure on the dollar, mask the weakness of the dollar by provoking a dramatic fall in the euro. This is the way this system proposes to survive, by essentially a process of self-cannibalization. And I'm afraid this term pigs, right? This the pigs, the Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain. This was invented by the guys in the trading pits, by the Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, Morgan Stanley people. This is unacceptable. Now, what should be done? I see that Bill Engdahl seems to suggest that a bailout for Greece, led by Germany, would be a good thing. that the treaty bans it, but that there's a way to do it. I don't think that's the way to go at all. He does admit that it's obviously better to keep the IMF out, and we'll go through one or two other possible solutions for Greece in just a minute, back on World Crisis Radio.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Back to World Crisis Radio. So what should Greece actually do? I don't think a bailout for Greece is the answer. We've seen what bailouts do here in the United States. This is basically the hot money approach, and you just have that money flee overseas. You'd be reviving these banks. Max Kaiser suggests that Greece would be stronger after a crash and that they've got to go through the crash. And I guess that is the approach of the Austrian school. But unfortunately, if you have a crash, this gets you the destruction of an entire generation. And the experience of the 1930s does not allow us to assume that there is an automatic business cycle that lifts these countries out of depression. Remember, Heinrich Brüning and Andrew Mellon tried to argue that if you liquidated stocks and real estate, bonds, labor, and everything else, that you would then get a recovery. But I don't see any evidence that there ever was a recovery. So I would say what Greece needs is what everybody else needs, which is a good dose of New Deal, re-regulation, and some renationalization of what used to be their state sector. If you compare this to the Roman Empire, right, Tiberius and Gaius Gracchus at one point came forward and said, we've got to have land reform and we've got to cut the role of slavery in the territories conquered from Carthage in the Punic Wars. In the Han Dynasty in China, where you had a similar feudalization going on, the famous Wang Mang, contemporary approximately of Christ, came forward and said, we've got to have reforms. In many ways, the Wall Street sales tax, the Tobin tax, securities transfer tax or trading tax, is the equivalent of that. Remember, the AFL-CIO is for it. Robert Kuttner, a liberal economist, is for it. Congressman DeFazio of Oregon, for it. And there's a ferment for it. Japanese finance officials are in favor of a national Tobin tax, trading tax on speculators. Let's just call it a Wall Street sales tax, because none of those flows are taxed so far. Elementary self-defense for Greece would be to say, slap a 1% tax on all derivatives, stocks, bonds, options, futures, indices, combinations, and permutations thereof, all paper transactions, 1%. And again, in just about every country, there's a value-added tax or a sales tax. Somehow the bankers are exempt. They think that they're the French aristocracy before 1789, when the Ancien Régime aristocrats said, we have the rare privilege of being exempt from all taxation. And when Colbert rightly tried to tax them, they were able to fight it off back under Louis XIV. Similarly in Spain, right, the Hidalgo said to the central government under Lerma and Olivares, you're not going to tax us. We refuse to be taxed. So we today have a banking oligarchy class that claims that they're exempt from all taxation. And indeed, Goldman Sachs pays, what, 2%, 3% corporate income tax. We want to get them right at the source, right at their turnover, even before they begin to make money. We want to show them that this is not for free, because the social costs of this are enormous. In other words, concrete measures to rein in the bubble economy, to cut down financialization, and to, again, take the life out of the speculative booze for these characters. Greece otherwise should, of course, consider a debt moratorium. 35 countries, just in the past 25 years or so, have gone through debt moratorium. We know Mexico under López Portillo, Brazil in 1987, debt moratorium, and then Argentina under Rodríguez Saá in 2001. This was then administered by Néstor Kirchner. And many others. And indeed, if the Icelanders don't get a decent deal from the British and the Dutch, they should simply declare a debt moratorium. We will need, generally speaking, a freeze on all payments on international financial debt, including derivatives. And if you think that's radical, well, this starts really with Herbert Hoover in 1931 proposed the Hoover moratorium, which was a one-year suspension on war debts and reparations after World War I as a response to the Depression. So here is Mr. Hidebound Republican free market orthodoxy himself, Herbert Hoover, with the Hoover moratorium, saying we just can't have the world paying for this. Of course, the fatal flaw of his proposal was that it was only a year, and that at that time it had to be 5 years or the duration of the World Economic Depression, whichever lasts longer. Greece would obviously need exchange controls and capital controls. The problem is they can't do it because they have the euro. Now, here, what is the oligarchical strategy? It would seem that the hedge funds are determined to press the attack on Greece, to press the attack on Spain, on Ireland, perhaps, on Portugal, and then ultimately on Italy, third largest sovereign debtor in the world. Notice the one country that does not get on the pigs list is the British. The United Kingdom is growing its national debt faster than any other country in Europe. They have a full 13% plus deficit compared to GDP, but of course they're supposed to be the beneficiaries of all this. If the hedge funds, the Soros people, and so forth press this speculative assault, shorting Greek bonds and the bonds of these other countries, shorting the euro, they have a possibility of attaining the breakup of the euro, which would have a certain chaotic effect. On the other hand, it would also have positive byproducts. A country like Greece, if they went back to the drachma, they could then engage in various kinds of self-defense, such as exchange controls and capital controls to throttle the flow of speculative attack. In other words, they could take effective self-defense measures. They could also then begin to think about a modest protective tariff, which basically is going to be needed. If the Eurogarchs and Eurocrats of Brussels and Frankfurt are not willing to do some obvious things, to take measures to have a Tobin tax at the European Union level, 1% tax would be a wonderful thing for Europe to begin to drain this swamp of speculation, and also some idea of other protectionist, mercantilist, dirigist, cameralist measures, then ultimately this is going to break up. And that's, again, that's the Soros track record from 1992. That attack led to the temporary complete disruption of the European rate mechanism, and the British dropped out. So if you press an attack, in those days there was no common currency, and the British are still not in it. The Greeks are in the euro, but they may not be in the euro for long. So essentially, this is now the second wave of the Depression. And one of the effects of the second wave of the Depression is that the Tea Party people, who have now been sold, at least to a significant degree, on this, I think, rather superficial litany of let's balance the budget, let's have tax cuts somehow compatible, and let's reduce government spending. This makes no sense. If you, in a Depression, cut your budget, if you destroy your social safety net and your education budget, you'll come back with a bigger deficit the following year. because government spending is such an important part of overall economic activity. You cut that, you cut your tax receipts, you cut the general level, you'll have a bigger deficit. The more you cut, the bigger your deficit will be. Back in a minute.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Idea, therefore, that you can solve a depression by balancing the budget. Well, that's straight Herbert Hoover, isn't it? You cut the budget, you try to balance the budget, and of course the additional Tea Party demand, you have to have across the board tax cuts, meaning that the mass of the money, since it's a percentage tax cut, goes to the wealthiest taxpayers. That is a recipe for disaster. That's going to make the depression much worse. It is essentially a petty bourgeois rebellion. It is similar to the Perot movement of 92. And the focus on that was deficit reduction, cut spending, and restore the kitchen table virtues. Unfortunately, the role of a government, modern state in a national economy is not comparable to what goes on around the kitchen table for reasons that really ought to be obvious. The government can set interest rates to control the money supply, carry out capital investments in the form of infrastructure. Sovereign state really cannot default if it's properly run. But the Perot people demanded this deficit reduction, and this set the stage for some of the worst things that Clinton did, was this constant stress on this. It also takes us back to Pujadisme. Pujad, this was a movement in France in the 1950s. Again, petty bourgeois, small shopkeepers and peasants, right? Small farmers demanding the same kind of stuff, right? Government restraint. In Italy, also very interesting, the uomo qualunque, the average guy, the man in the street, the regular person movement of the 1940s, right after the war, interesting from our point of view because it was led by a comedian, a guy called Giannini. When you see Glenn Beck, a clown from the Hippodrome, showing up as the leader of the Tea Party movement and the 9/12 agitation and demanding that it all be done just as around the kitchen table. This is the abdication and bankruptcy of any kind of economic science or understanding. And these movements essentially get you nowhere. Remember, there are only four things you can do in a depression. You have four choices. One is cut the budget, remove all the bailouts, and don't do anything else. That gets you an immediate deflationary crash, which I think is a tragic and horrendous outcome. It's going to destroy one generation right away. It'll blight the lives of everybody who's in college, about to leave college, young people trying to find jobs. It disrupts an entire generation, and there's no guarantee that any recovery will ever follow. So we don't want the immediate deflationary crash, the Bruning or Andrew Mellon approach, because also that tends to destroy the possibility of democratic institutions. That's what Bruning did between 1931 and 1932. And you know what came after that. The democratic institutions had been destroyed and totalitarian dictatorship was the result. So you don't want to mess around with deflationary crashes, cutting the budget, destroying social services. You essentially destroy your form of government. The other thing you can do is a hot money recovery. That's what Bernanke is doing, the dollar carry trade, right? You can borrow dollars for zero, and you can take them to Greece or Spain and get 8 or 9% or Turkey or wherever it is. That does not produce a recovery here at home. It just weakens the currency. It drives down the dollar so that you have to do these desperate things like the attack on Greece by attacking their bonds. Then, of course, there's the Keynesian consumer-led recovery. This is what Pelosi believes in, right? This is the most or much of the $780 billion or more stimulus bill is designed simply to pump money into various kinds of consumer spending. And unfortunately, recovery does not come from consumer spending. It comes from capital goods. You've got to invest your money in a way that will increase the stock of capital goods, increase the productivity of labor, set the stage for a recovery, and indeed be a recovery. So that's the other possibility. So no to the immediate deflationary crash, no to the hot money recovery, no to the Keynesian consumer-led. And that leaves us with the one that we need. And this is the experience of Germany in the early 1930s. What you've got to do is either nationalize the Federal Reserve, nationalize the central bank. This works everywhere. Nationalize the European Central Bank, and if you can't do that, nationalize the Bank of Greece and all the individual countries, and use those central banks then, force them to issue 0% credit for recovery. And in this country, that means stop federal borrowing. Stop it. No more borrowing by the federal government. Switch to federal lending, where it's the nationalized Bank of the United States, the ex-Federal Reserve, as part of the Treasury now, obedient to laws passed by Congress and signed by the President, debated in public. That becomes the engine of 0% federal credit for recovery. And let's look at what you might do with that, say, in this country. Very interesting interview on the Sunday talk shows last Sunday. Arnold Schwarzenegger, the governor of California, and Ed Rendell of Pennsylvania, Republican and Democrat. And what are they talking? The need for massive construction of infrastructure. We know that the amount of infrastructure in this Pelosi stimulus was less than $100 billion, probably in the neighborhood of $80 billion or something like that, if you put together the highway funds and the Army Corps of Engineers. That's not enough. We've gone through that if you want to build 100 reactors at $7 billion per nuclear reactor, that's $700 billion right there. That would have been a much better, much more effective stimulus than what this consumer spending stuff that Pelosi went with. Obviously, I'm in favor of maintaining the social safety net, Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, unemployment benefits, WIC, all of that, Head Start. That's all got to be fully funded. No ifs, ands, or buts. And that's where the Tobin tax comes in. But in terms of getting a recovery as distinct from maintaining your workforce while you're getting the recovery, you've got to do that with capital investments in infrastructure. And this is the gospel that Schwarzenegger is now preaching. I cite this not because I believe in Schwarzenegger. I don't, please. But that the times are changing and the governors are much more practical and much less ideological and much less fanatical than, for example, Republican members of the House of Representatives, who are one of the biggest groups of ideological fanatics that you'd ever see. And the Democrats, similarly, in their own way, infrastructure. So Arnie goes through this thing saying the basis of civilization is infrastructure. Great civilizations begin to crash and fall when they allow their infrastructure to decay. So the U.S. infrastructure obviously is very, very thoroughly decayed. And he talks about this. He says in 5 years, the port of Shanghai will have a throughput greater than all ports of the United States combined. So Shanghai alone, the great central port in Sun Yat-sen's 1919 International Development of China, which seems to be what they're working off, the port of Shanghai will have imports and exports greater in volume than all the ports of the United States combined. So he says California needs $10 billion for fast rail. It's not ideal, but it's a start. He wants $10 billion for water projects, water systems, water management in California. This is interesting. He says a $2.2 trillion deficit of U.S. infrastructure that has got to be addressed. Now, just watch out. Lazard Frere is in there skimming when it's Schwarzenegger and Mandel. But this is essentially correct. So 100 reactors in 20 months, not 20 years, and that would put you on the road to real economic recovery. So get control of the Fed, force them to issue 0% credit, and build infrastructure massively. And we'll be in touch with you here on World Crisis Radio and Talkly.net.